Accession number 28626, reel 15.
For a given period of time. So you would see occasionally people from Pakistan, Australia, obviously, who work with us. We had two Australians on our course. They were there for 2 years at a time. There's an American officer, exchange officer, Canadian exchange officers. Quite often there was a French and a German officer as well. So there were other people there on the staff who had a specific function, but the only army was there was the British Army.
And whilst you were there as well, from the period 85 to 87, did the IRA ever threaten was it a barracks?
Yeah, it was very much a barracks. Uh-huh. Interestingly enough, when I first went there, the fence around the camp was an ordinary field fence, i.e. just, you know, barbed wire top and some soft wire, and that's it, just an ordinary fence. But during the period sort of 83 to 85, 87, the IRA decided to increase the targets, and the school infantry became a target, like nearly every other barracks in the country and in Germany. So the security was stepped up significantly, and got the old sort of agricultural fence went out, and in its place we got 6.5 foot steel fencing with barbed wire on the top, razor wire on the top. Some of it was electrified or alarmed. Whole new ball game, and it really cut up the camp. The camp was quite a nice size and shape, but this stuff was put in such a way that it segmented it and departmentalized it. And you went from one bit to the next bit, and you went through all these security things again. And you had to have passes to get in and move to these places. So it became quite, we all know why it was done. To my knowledge, there were some recces apparently conducted by the IRA, but there wasn't actually an attack executed on it, I understand. So,
if when you said that as well, you know that it became a whole new ball game. I don't mean just in this period, but over the period of time, maybe up until then, did the whole threat from the IRA and how you maybe had to look at security, did that all become, you know, was that all like a whole new ball game changing? And
yeah, it became, the IRA took, they took their bombing campaign and shootings out of Ireland. They were quite prepared to operate on mainland Europe, on mainland Britain. There were incidents, numerous incidents, where the IRA have shot officers, senior NCOs, soldiers dead getting out of their car, or blown them up because they haven't checked their car. They were looking for targets like military bases. They did deal, the Royal Marines Band at Deal. You know, these things were happening about that time, and we all had to play catch up. You know, we thought, they're operating across here. These are very sophisticated blokes. They'd learned their trade in various parts of the world. They had support.
Last section?
Five.
Okay, I think it's number five. And you were speaking about the threat of the IRA.
Yeah, this thing that the IRA had taken their campaign out of Northern Ireland, out of Southern Ireland, and had started to target British military personnel and civilian personnel in Northwest Europe, on mainland Britain, and indeed elsewhere, because they were becoming bold. They were very successful. They had support from other terrorist organisations throughout the world. They had other funding coming in, not just the stuff that we all know about the American connection, but other people were providing them with assistance, many of which thought might be in the Middle East or North Africa or Central America. So a lot was going on, and it was quite clear that we, the British Army, the services as a whole, had to take responsibility for our own security, and therefore we needed to get fencing up and defend that from inside and outside our static bases. And I think that was the sensible approach. Whilst it looked horrendous and it meant that people were doing many more guard duties, checking their car on a regular basis, doing all these things, you have to ask yourself, what price life? So it was a sensible way of going about it, and probably reduced the number of casualties by hundreds in doing so.
What about your home? You know, was your home within the confines of the barracks, or was it out with?
Our home was about out with the confines of the barracks, and were not protected in any way, shape or form.
So had you to do anything yourself?
The only thing we did, a matter of course, was always check our vehicle before we went into it. And we had, the army issued us with mirrors. So you put your mirror in your wife's handbag, and you put it out, extend the handle, and stick it down with a light on it, and have a look. The only thing you had to watch, of course, is that some of the devices that the IRA learned to use were light sensitive. So there's a bit of a double-edged weapon there, but in principle, this mirror with its torch on allowed you to look underneath your car to see if anybody had attached something nasty to your exhaust or to your axles or whatever, so that when you drove off and it vibrated, it would go off, or there'd be a tilt switch would operate when you went over a hump or got to a certain speed or whatever. So these were useful little things we had.
Okay. And you stayed at Warminster for 2 years?
Yeah, just over 2 years. We were at Elm Hill for 2.5 years because I did my JDSC thing beforehand.
Okay. And what happened then?
After that, my tour was up and I handed over to a guy called Captain Tim Light, who was from the King's Regiment, but he came in as an instructor, not as DS Cord. I don't know who was selected to do DS Cord after I left. I went back to the Gordons. CO was Lieutenant Colonel Jack Stenhouse, and at that point in time, we were running into the last 6-7 months of the air mobile trial, and Colonel Jack wanted me to take over from Major Nick Sutton as OCD company and see the last bit of the trial, complete the last bit of the trial. So that's what I did. So I went back to Germany. Jane did not come with me because you in those days you weren't allowed to take your wife with you if you were only to be there 6 months, and that was the case because the Gordons were about to get posted from there, back to the UK.
What did she do in the meantime? Did you have a home?
Yeah, she went to Edinburgh. She moved up to Edinburgh, and we took over a quarter in Edinburgh, which was fine, because that was just near her parents, only about 400 yards away. So that was good at Redford. But I went back out to Hamer and lived in the mess. I lived in the mess for a bit, but it was so awful that I went to actually and shared a flat with the battalion second in command, Major Brian Nicol. His wife, unfortunately, had died. Liz had died, so Brian was on his own. And we were there. He was older than me, but I was one of the old ones in the mess at this stage, and the other lads were all youngsters. And there wasn't a huge amount of space anyhow, so eventually I moved out and shared the flat, this big flat, with him.
And why did you think the mess was awful?
It was, the youngsters were running around, just not causing trouble, but I think that the balance was changing. They were making a racket and, it's all things that we'd done when we were subalterns, but actually I didn't need that at that point. I was trying to study for my staff exam, and you could not do it properly for the racket that was going on. And you had to appreciate, this is their home as much as it was mine, but the idea of saying to them, as I often did, can you please keep quiet, someone's going to try to work, meant nothing. They like to enjoy themselves, and it just became, after 6 months, it became a little wearing. It was deemed best to move out.
Okay, so you were thinking of going forward, that you were thinking of studying for this exam?
Oh, you had to. We all had to.
Okay.
I unfortunately wasn't in a position to be allowed to go away. The CEO wouldn't let me have time off to cram for it. So I had to do it and run the company. at the end of the trial, which was it proved impossible because I wasn't able to study effectively enough to get the right qualification to get a place at Staffordshire. So whilst I passed the exam, it just meant that I was unlikely to get picked up for half colonel or anything above that for the foreseeable future, if at all. Which rather, in my mind, said, well, here's a typical example of I'm not one of the Gordon's favourite sons. This is just typifies the way you treat certain officers where others are allowed time off to go and do the crammer.
Sometimes it would have been allowed, would it?
Well, three of them, four of us taking the exam, three were allowed to go away, I wasn't. I was the only one as a company commander. I was the senior one, but I wasn't allowed to go away. But that's just the way personalities go, and you have to take rough and smooth. But it was a busy time. I took over from Major Nick Sutton, sorted out a few problems there, and took the company on the various exercises that was required of us to complete this trial. I was also made OC of the skiing that year, which was done down at Sonthofen in Bavaria. The principle was in Germany that all the infantry, well, most of the regiments and corps out there had a skiing hut, a very smart German schloss, you know, that type of thing. And you would send a platoon or a company's worth of guys down from your base, wherever it was in Germany, by bus down to your ski hut, and they would spend a week or 2 weeks down there doing adventure training, but we're talking skiing and some langlaufing, but downhill and langlaufing. Down there we had a team of instructors, sort of lance corporals, corporals, sergeants, commanded by an officer, captain, and they would run the hut. There was obviously caterers down there, there were some transport guys down there. So it was a proper organised little outfit. My job was to oversee that and go down and do my annual inspection and get a feel for it and try and sort any problems if there were any, so that the captain would phone me up and say, I've got a problem with this, can you help? And I would sort it from the camp end. And I went down on my visit, and I'd never skied before, and a nice young chap called Corporal Reed, he said, can I ski? I said, no, never ski. He said, great, sir, absolutely fantastic, this is what I wanted to hear. We'll sort you out. So he went and got me some boots and some skis. He told me to report to him tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. I did. We went up on the chairlift, miles up this hill, fantastic views. And he said, right, I'm going to give you 2 minutes on how to ski, and then just follow me. So he said, this is how you do a snowplow. This is how I want you to turn when we're going down the piste. Really, there's nothing more to it, is there? So off he went. And I went down this slope with him, and it was very gentle to start with. It was gorgeous, you know. I was still falling over. Then suddenly changed from being gentle to being 45 degrees, pretty fast. We started doing some turning. I started doing even more falling over. Then halfway down, there was a sudden turn to the left. And I went straight on and ended up in a tree, about 12 feet off the ground. Fell out the tree into the snow, was covered up. Anyhow, I picked myself up and completed the rest of the hill, falling over as I went. Got to the bottom, much laughter from Corporal Reed and a few others, so we went back up again. And I went down the hill and I fell a few more times, but I knew what I was doing, I was getting better. Anyhow, on the fourth attempt, I got down the hill without falling over. And I was chuffed a bit. At which point Corporal Reed said, right, come on, we're going to go even further up. We're going to the top of the hill, and you're going to go on a black run. And I said, well, what was that run we've just done? That was a blue run. I said, hang on a minute, we're supposed to start on yellow or something, you know, beginners. He said, not for you. We're up to the big stuff. So anyhow, up the top of the hill, got off the chairlift, and on my right, as I looked back down the hill, which is a beautiful piece of pisted sort of snow, there was a cliff. That's all I can describe it as, a cliff probably 40 metres high. And he said, right, that's what we're going to do. And I just looked at him and I said, you're taking the piss. There's no way we're doing that. And he said, no, I said, nobody skis on that. At which point, two blokes came round the corner on the edges of their skis down this cliff. And I said, Corey Reed, I'm not doing it. And he just said, I'm just winding up, sir. Just follow me. So we went off. And we went down this lovely bit of ice, very fast, which then joined into the blue run that I'd already done. And it was great. And the next day, I did the same thing again for a few times and managed to stay on my feet, which is great. But I haven't skied since then. And it was a good experience. And, you know, I'm indebted to Corporal Reed for being so patient and having a laugh at my expense, but we got it done. And I went back and wrote up the report, the annual report for the skiing, and that was it, done and dusted. That was our last time, and we then had to basically move on from the ski hut that we'd had for Ski Gasson. It was a fantastic, fantastic building.
It looked quite plush.
Oh yeah, very smart. Beautiful. Three stories, wooden. You know, the advert you see for Swiss chocolate, you know, with fantastic hills and mountains with snow on and cows and water, and just absolutely glorious. Lovely people owned it, really, really good to us. And it was, we were very sorry to see them go. We were very sorry to leave them. But I'm sure they picked up another unit after that, and they went on from strength to strength. We did think about trying to keep it on from Scotland, but it wasn't going to work. We didn't do it. And so, you know, that's, we finished off that tour in Germany. The Aeromobile trial had been a success. It was good, and the army decided that they would continue with an Aeromobile brigade. And indeed, that's what's happened. And today is 16 Air Assault Brigade, which is parachute regiment heavy, but it has a Scottish battalion in it. And that's the Argyll and Southern Highlanders, 5 Scots. They're part of that team. And indeed, deploying to Afghanistan in the next week and so on, there are units from 4 Scots, the Highlanders, B Company, under Major Phil White, and also from 2 Scots, the RHF, along with 5 Scots, are all going with 16 Air Assault to Afghanistan to start their 6-month tour. So it's proved dividends. I don't suppose for one second that 16 Air Assault will be acting in quite the way we did with the helicopters in Germany, because obviously Afghanistan is not Northwest Europe. The issues are different. The intensity of fighting is completely over and above what we experienced on our trial. But nonetheless, it was that trial that has borne the 16 Air Assault Brigade.
And so when you did come back from Germany, did you travel individually or did you come back in a group?
Now that's a good question. I think we came back individually because we all had cars and stuff. So basically you finished on a Friday, let's say, and you were told to report for duty the following Wednesday to the new camp, which in our case was Fort George up in Inverness.
Had you been there before?
I hadn't served there before. I'd been there, but I'd never actually served there. So we went back to Fort George, and I rejoined my missus, who by that stage had been allocated a quarter at Tobruk Road, Wimberley Way, Tobruk Road, just next door to Cameron Barrett, where I now work. Literally.
So that was in March 1988?
Yeah.
Okay, so the house that you were allocated, was that a private let, or was that...
No, this is an army quarter. There's a very... very small group of officers' quarters, which butts onto quite a number of soldiers' quarters. It's a nice little estate. It's well maintained even to this day.
And the officers' accommodation, was that better than the soldiers'?
It was a house. We had our house had 3 bedrooms, 3 small bedrooms. It wasn't a big house. It was a I think you call it a semi-detached, i.e. there's our house on the other side of the wall, but they weren't big houses, and they had a tiny garden at the back of them, but they were classified as officers' quarters because they were in a street, Tobruk Street, and our main were officers, and the other streets were the soldiers, but they were only 50 yards away. So there's, you know, I don't suppose the houses were really that different, to be honest.
And was it a good thing, do you think, or a bad thing that you were so close to the soldiers?
Never struck us as being a problem. Just didn't enter us as being a problem. We just, you know, we all got on with things, and yeah, we know these guys and these girls, so we just, that's what you do.
Okay. And now you started back in Fort George.
Yeah.
What was your job there? What was your position?
I was moved from D Company, and I became OC Headquarter Company. So I was looking after the biggest company in the battalion, but within that company there are various departments, like the Quartermaster's Department, the Military Transport Department, and these departments all have their own officers in charge of them. It could be a major or a captain. Normally they were late entry commission officers who'd worked their way up through the ranks, perhaps been RSM or company sergeant major, and had got promoted to officer. And they were in charge of their specific departments, but they were all under my direction as the company commander. I had a number of jobs when I was in Fort George. Colonel Jack Spenhouse seemed to like me so much that he just said, anything coming up, just pass it on to Morris. So I had a bag full of different jobs and hats to wear. One of the most enjoyable, funny enough, was undertaking the netting rights that had been granted to the soldier occupiers of Fort George by one of the kings centuries before that, and they had never been revoked. So I got six soldiers. I took advice from a guy called Chris Swift, who'd fished there before, who's a civilian, and who had a small farm at Bewley. We borrowed one of his tractors and trailers and nets and boats and outboard motors and rocks and oars and stuff, and we took them back to Fort George. He showed us what to do, and we started fishing, the six of us. And fishing meant that we would probably do 4 hours a day, and you'd motor the net out in a big loop. You'd anchor one end to the shore, you'd motor out, turn right, and then come back in again. So shooting the net in an arc of perhaps 60 metres out, 60 metres up, and 60 metres back in again. So quite a big net. And then you'd bring the two ends together, you'd attach the rope to the back of the tractor, which had a winch on, and you would turn the engine on, and the net would be brought in. And hopefully you had fish, salmon, in that net. Well, we caught, in the 3 weeks that we fished, and you really only fish when the tide is rising, and at high tide point you're as well stopping, because slack water, the fish don't move. So we fished about 4 hours a day, twice a day, just when the water was coming up, dark or night or day, and we caught, if I remember rightly, just under 1,000 fish. The biggest one was a 36-pound cod salmon, and I'll never forget a young lad, I think his name was Reed, was in the water, and the net was literally, it was all but in on the beach. There's probably only 6 feet of net left out in the water. And this young lad walked out in his waders, his half knee-length waders. And he was hit by a fish. And he ran up the beach like one of the guys out of a cartoon that's seen a ghost or something. Anyhow, we got the net in, and there was a 36-pound salmon, which is a fish of about 3.5-4 feet in length, and a depth of maybe a foot. Absolutely solid, silver, fantastic fish. But it just proves how difficult it was to see it in the water, because we could not see that fish, and it didn't break the surface. It just had come in, and when he went into the water, it had hit him. And it was fantastic. These fish were all got. I had deep freezers in my office, four of them. And it's not like a fish factory. But I used to freeze these fish. I normally took the ones that had been net marked. So when the fish had gone and managed to get its head or gills through the net, it left a mark. And these were difficult to sell on the commercial market. So I'd sell them to the regimental family. And so they would all get their fresh salmon frozen. and where they went. All the good ones, and we're talking hundreds of good fish and sea trout, went down to one of the fish smokers on the industrial estate in Inverness. And I would sell those at best price, at whatever we can get for them. We made £11,500 profit in those 3 weeks. And unfortunately, all that money, every single penny of it, had to go on an insurance claim for a marquee that had been put up in the fort, hadn't been secured properly, and took off and was destroyed by a wind because it hadn't been insured. So it was basically 3 weeks of fun with no reward. And not for us, but for the money was going back into the PRI, the President of the Regular Institute, which is the shop, and it would benefit the jocks, which was very disappointing.
And what was the marquee being used for?
The marquee was erected for the colours parade, because one of the things we did in 1988 was we had our old colours laid up, and our new colours were... what's the right word? Padre...
Presented?
No, the dedicated.
Uh-huh.
The new colours were dedicated, and then they were marched round, and so it was for that, and we had a big gathering at the fort, on the grass outside the officers' mess and battalion headquarters. Very good parade, lots of, four companies marching. A really good day. All of the regimental family there, lots of, grandfathers and parents and wives and kids and the press and Lord Lieutenants, and a really good day. Prince Charles was there. And then following that, we did a Highland Games and bits and pieces. So it was a very good regimental weekend. And the tent, the marquee, was for the officers and senior NCOs' ball. The officers got theirs. The senior NCOs didn't, because the tent blew away. Literally, from the middle of Fort George, it was picked up. It was hurled over the north wall into the Murray Firth, and when recovered, it was in bits, and it hadn't been insured.
They had to pay for it.
Yeah, that was
a shame. And what were the battalion doing there? What were they doing? Was it training or?
We were back there in a light role. It just happened to be one of the permanent bases, and that's where they were sent back. We did an awful lot of public duties. The companies were away in Edinburgh a lot. They were on Balmoral Guard once that year as well, or during that tour. So then whilst you're based at Fort George, to be fair, they were hardly there. I remember, in spite of having the biggest company in the battalion, there's some 240 strong, I think there's only about 60 of us at one stage left there, because the rest of the lads were away assisting the other companies.
And did you ever go down to Edinburgh with them? Or?
No,
you didn't go in the public, did you?
No, it's not something that OC headquarters company had to do, which is fine.
Okay, so you were there from the March to the August.
Yep.
And then where did you go in August 88?
Well, before I did that, I actually moved on, we were asked by ITV if we would take part in what they call a telethon. So you try and raise funds for various things, and so I was asked by the CEO if I would do something for this telethon.